Welcome to the NutGallery.com podcast. I'm Jason Schulte. Today's podcast is going to be a special podcast where we interview Mark Ashton and Libby J. Atwater. They're the authors of the book, The Spirit of Villarosa, that came out on June 28th. To find more information on that book, please go to www.thespiritofvillarosa.com. And it is a book that is not only about Mark Ashton, but also about his father, Horace Ashton, who was an adventurer in the early 1900s, and just has an incredible story. So I hope you enjoy the interview. First question, let's start off with talking a little bit about the background of the book and how you tie a kidnapping and a promise to write the story, and how that all came about to even the envisioning of starting the book.
Okay, how much time are you going to give me, Jason? Do you want the all 408 pages, or should I give you the short version,
just
25-cent version?
The 25-cent is fine.
Okay. Well, I grew up with an older father. When I was born, my father was 57. By the time I got to understand anything really in life, let's say when I'm 10 years old, he was 67. And I grew up listening to this man tell these fantastic stories. He moved to Haiti. He moved our family to Haiti in 1940 as a cultural attaché with the U.S. government, which happens to be right in the middle of the Second World War, and Haiti was a kind of an important, much more important strategically to us then than it is today. But anyway, us, when I say us, the United States. So growing up and listening to this man tell these unbelievable stories, I, out of respect to the my father, I listened to the stories, but, as I was getting older and time was moving on, I was saying to myself, there's no way somebody could have done all of these things. Just thinking of the logistics that were involved, it was impossible. So as time went on and I was listening to the stories, he was such a good storyteller that I brought out a little tape recorder, and it was a reel-to-reel tape recorder at the time, and I had him record some of his stories. But when you're telling a story to a tape recorder and you're telling a story to a bunch of people, it's two different things. But anyway, at least I had that done, and I had a dear friend that admired him tremendously, put it in a manuscript form, which is a series of short stories of his stories that are in the book. And as time went on, and after my father passed away at the age of 92, his 94-year-old sister sent me a scrapbook of articles and photos and clippings and things that she had kept while he was doing all these crazy things. And just when I received that scrapbook, I had a major guilt trip. Bottom line, for the first time, I had the proof of all these things that this man was saying that he had done, and I never believed them. I didn't think it was possible. Now, all of a sudden, I had the proof, and I had a major guilt trip on how stupid I had been for not listening more attentively and not paying more attention, because I didn't think it was possible, and now, here's all, it's all documented. So then I said, oh my God, I gotta do something with this. I've gotta put this story out there, and have the world understand what kind of a man this man was, how unique in those times and what have you. And then I was kidnapped. And prior to the kidnapping and all of the family situation before my father passed away, he would tell me, and he knew I didn't believe in what he was saying, but he would tell me, and he told our daughters, my daughter, 7 year at the time, she was seven, you have nothing to worry about. I benefited of a guardian angel all my life, and when I pass, I will be your guardian angel, and I will be looking after you and your family, and so on, so you have nothing to worry about. So then, fast forward, I get kidnapped. A situation is a kidnapping for ransom, I was the third person person that was kidnapped. It was beginning of a new industry in 2001. Two Americans were kidnapped before me. The first one 2 weeks before me and was killed. The second one was a week before me and was killed. And I was the third American in 3 weeks. And I kind of felt like I had a pattern being formed there. And I kind of made up my mind that there's only one way I'm going to get out of here alive is to take things in my hands. And even if a ransom is paid, my chances of coming out alive are very slim. And during the whole ordeal, which is a nine-hour ordeal, while I'm trying to figure out, for the first two or three minutes were very terrifying. The rest of it becomes a survival game. We have in us, we all have, when we're faced with death, we have strengths and certain powers. I don't want to call them powers, but we have the ability to survive and to find a way to try to survive. And during this whole thing, as time was going on and my mouth taped and my eyes taped occasionally off and on, then when your mouth is taped and your eyes are taped and you have nothing you can do, but I started praying. I'm not a very religious person. I'm a believer, but I'm not a religious person. I go to church for a wedding or a funeral, but I'm not a church-going person. And during these prayers, which... more to give yourself self-confidence and build up your self-confidence and strength, I remembered that my father had always said he'd be our guardian angel, and I said, I made a pact, so to speak, with him at that time, where I said, okay, Dad, all you had, you always claimed to have these fantastic powers, and he was a very unique person, you'll see when you get the book, but now, all I'm asking you for is show me the opportunity. Give me an opportunity. If you really have all these strengths and powers, give me the opportunity, and I will take care of it. And if I get out alive of this, I promise that I will publish your book and get the world to understand who you were and whatever. So bottom line, that's how the book came. And then when I... in 2001, I moved to Florida right after they sold our house rapidly, and all of that. There's a lot of detail in the book about that. And I came here and I started working on the book indirectly through a historian organization. I had met with Libby. We started working a little bit. Things were not going well as the other person that was involved. I was not what Libby was getting from me was not. Coming from me, it was coming through a third person, and what I was getting back from Libby was through a third person. So I put it on the back burner for a while. But for the last 5 or 6 years, I started really working on it again because I had this commitment that I had to live up to in my for myself, for my conscience. And just so happened about, and again, as you will read when you read the book, there's a lot of quote, coincidences, end quote, that take place in this whole scene, whole scenario. Libby, about a week before I signed the contract with a publishing company, I receive an email from Libby, who I had not spoken to or heard from for over 10 years, I would say, Libby, roughly. Correct me if I'm wrong. But then Libby said, I don't know if you remember me. I worked with you on your book, and if you... haven't done anything with it. I would like I have my manuscript that I put together. I would like to have your authorization to go ahead and do publish my version of the story. And I answered right back to Libby, saying, Libby, well, this is amazing because I'm in the process. I've already been discussing with a publishing company. And she said, no, please wait. So we exchanged manuscripts. And we then went back to the drawing board. And we've got the finished product that I'm very proud of, and I'm sure Libby has reason to be very proud of. And Denise has been a sweetheart, and she's probably the of the three of us, she is the driver of our enthusiasm, shall I say. So with that, I don't know if I answered your question, Jason. I need to warn you. I've spent most of my life in Haiti, and Haitians talk with their hands, and when they get going, it's hard to turn them off. So, well, I'll try to shut up for a while. We'll see if I answered your questions.
You did. Maybe we'll have Libby jump in a little bit and talk about when you first heard some of this story and how it inspired you to want to write the manuscript.
Well, when I first heard this story, I was amazed, first of all, that that anyone could go through such a terrifying ordeal. But then, while I was, first of all, when I got the story, I should backtrack, I did not get the kidnapping at first. At first, I got the transcripts of Horace's story, Mark's father's story, and I was enchanted with them. And I wasn't sure what to do with them. And the person I was working with at the time, who I was a subcontractor, said, well, I'm not sure what Mark wants to do with these stories. I said, well, do you want me to edit them? Do you want me to transform them into more readable work? And then she came back to me and said, let's make this a father-son story, and I'll interview Mark. So she began interviewing Mark, and I started getting bits and pieces of information, but it still wasn't a complete story. And then the kidnapping came up, and I thought, gee, that's really interesting. This wasn't mentioned initially. And she said, we want three different narratives. We want the kidnapping, the father's story, and the son's story. And as Mark mentioned, that didn't really work out. But I did that. And that's how I got involved in the story initially. And I thought, this is such a wonderful story. And then I put it away in the closet for 11 years, I believe. I contacted you in 2014, Mark.
Correct.
But I contacted you right after the earthquake in Haiti because I was concerned that you still had family there. And that was a good, I got good feedback that no one was still there, and I was really sorry that that had happened. And I won't spoil the book for you, Jason. I won't tell you what else Mark told me that day. But then in 2014, when I contacted Mark, I said, you know, this is such a good story. The world needs to know this story. And in the interim between 2003, when I started working with Mark, and 2014, there was a movie with Albert Finney, I believe, called Big Fish that came out. And I thought of Mark immediately, and I thought of Horace, and I thought, these stories are too big or too unusual to be true. But then again, we had all this documentation, so I knew they were true. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but I was just enthralled with the story, and I thought, I had put a lot of work back into the book in 2003, and I'm not one who likes to fail. I think we learn from failure, and I also thought that I could do a better job with the story. So when I contacted Mark in 2014 and said, you know, would you allow me to tell this story, because I would never take a story without permission. That's not what I do. And he said, well, why don't I show you what I've been working on and what you've been working on? And when he showed me what he'd been working on, I liked his version better. Now, it's had several iterations since then. But this is a story that needs to be told. People, it captures a way of life that no longer exists. And it also gives insight. Mark thinks he's very different from his father, but as you read the book, you'll realize they're very much the same in many ways.
I take that as a compliment. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What I would like to add, Jason, is thanks to Libby, and that's where the problem I had in the beginning, my story was not being told like I would tell my story. My story was being told by a professional that knows how to tell stories, which was the third party that subcontracted to Libby. And Libby allowed me, when we got back together, she allowed me and helped me tell my story my way, the way I feel comfortable with, and the way I wanted the story to be told, and in the language, when I say language, Libby is she's the expert, and she's corrected all my grammatical errors and what have you, and helped me steer me when I was going off a cliff. She'd pull me back and say, oh no, we know here's the way around that issue, and here's and so forth. So Libby has been very instrumental in getting this to the level. She took a product that was not a finished product, which was going to go to print, and polished it beautifully. So,
thank you, Mark.
I thank you, Libby.
You're welcome.
To kind of go off of what was just said there, do you have a predisposed, genetically drawn to adventure and things like your father had?
I don't know. In a different form. I'm a risk taker, but I'm a much more, in my view, I'm not as spiritual a person as he was. I don't take, my risks are more calculated risks in the business sense. I'm not that much of an adventurer. I've done a lot of things that are kind of crazy things to do as I was growing up, like all my scuba diving and some of my hunting excursions and what have you, and living in a country that was obviously the handwriting was on the wall that this is not one of the safest places to be, and the future was kind of glum. But my aspect where I'm very different from my father. He was, in my view, not at all attracted or driven by the material side of anything. In other words, he was more totally on a spiritual level. He did what he wanted to do, where he wanted to do it, when he wanted to do it, regardless of the cost, regardless of the financial repercussions, and I'm just the opposite there. I make sure before I enter into something that I have the staying power to accomplish what I need to accomplish, and I keep my I have an objective. When I enter into whatever it may be, I have an objective that I keep clear in my mind. My father's objective was probably, as he well said over the years, his passion was to learn about people through their religions and through their beliefs. And he was fascinated with that. As a result, he became a expert on, you name whatever religion you want to talk about. He got enthralled in it and learned all about it from A to Z. But he was not a preacher. He was not a person that was. This was all knowledge for his own purposes and his own use. And myself, I've been more, struggling to make ends meet and pay for this the life of keep the man that did all these fantastic things, keep him afloat and keep him from losing his house with the mortgage and so on and so forth. And that's been my drive, and that's where there's some similarities and there's a lot of differences, I think.
Good. Maybe I'm trying to switch back and forth between the two of you a little bit. Libby, was it a challenge to take this larger-than-life character almost and then weave in Mark's story as well, that no one kind of overshadowed each other?
Yes, it was a huge challenge. It was probably the hardest work I've ever worked on or written in my life. And I felt that way back in 2003 when I initially started it. I found I didn't have a lot of information on Mark at that time, but we really got it out of him in the past 2 years, thanks to an assessment editor. But I enjoyed Horace's story so much, and I think when I wrote them or rewrote them or tried to put them into some kind of order, I felt like I was channeling Horace, like I was out there doing these things. And I am not an adventurer. I didn't learn how to snorkel until I was 40. but I do now. And so for me, I kind of lived vicariously through Horace, and just, I love history anyhow. And his stories were so amazing that it was wonderful weaving Mark's own story and then the story of the kidnapping in was difficult because there were a lot of pacing issues. And even our publisher said, I still want more of the pacing. It's too many chapters between Mark and Horace, et cetera. And I had to work really, really hard to do that. I also tried to distinguish Mark from Horace. Horace's adventures, his chapter titles are lengthy. Every single one of Mark's chapters, I think, has a one-word title, so that you know you're with Mark, like Taken and Contact, Freedom. And I did that on purpose to try and distinguish their two voices, you know, all the time. Whereas in the hard copy, we use different fonts to distinguish the speakers. So it was a very big challenge, but it was also, I really had fun. My passion is to write, and I had a great time first time around. You didn't know that, did you, Mark?
No, I certainly didn't. But it's been, Jason, first of all, Libby is to be commended tremendously for her patience and what have you, because I'm not an easy person to please. I'm kind of a perfectionist. I don't accept, it's an understatement to say I don't accept defeat. I don't accept anything mediocre. It has to be as good as it can possibly be. And as such, I was possibly maybe a little too demanding at certain times, but bottom line is we have had nothing but amazing raves about everybody that has gotten this book. The comments I'm getting back from on my side are just amazing. I get masterpiece. I get the magnificent document. I get must read. And it's fantastic. So I feel very, very, how would I say, proud is an understatement. I think I accomplished my objective, and now to finalize that, to really put the icing on the cake, Denia has been doing tremendous work getting the book out there. In other words, you know, I've told the story the way I'm very, very proud of the way it was told and the way it's put together and packaged, and now it's a matter of, you know, getting people to realize, you know, once they pick up the book, they can't put it down. That's the problem. It's getting the book, and the challenge now is getting it into somebody's hands like yourself. I'll wager with you, Jason, when you pick up, and you have experience, you read a lot of books, I'm sure, and seen a lot of movies, and you're going to see, once you get the, I don't think you can get a real feel. Well, I'm a dinosaur. I'm 76 years old, so I'm not like you're this young generation, Jason and Vinia and Libby. I'll include you in the young generation. But where, you know, I have to have something in my hands to really appreciate it. And when I'm on a tablet and reading a book on a tablet, I might get 50% of what I would get if I'm holding the book in my hands and reading it. So
it's a beautiful book, also. It's really, really pretty. And the photo, well, the photos come alive online, but I really think that the cover is amazing. And it was done, it was a copy of a painting of Villa Rosa that Horace made when he was in his 80s. He took a painting.
He started painting when he was 81, Jason. And he stopped painting when he had his stroke when he was 89. And during those eight years, he produced about 180 to 200 paintings, of which I still have 85 in my private collection here. But they're spread around the world a little bit. Barry Goldwater bought 4 of them. There's a fantastic story of one of those, and I won't get into it now. It's not even in the book, and it's not worth mentioning. But anyway, the man is one of these guys that... when he puts his mind to something, he does it, and there's no stopping him. So I used one of the paintings that he made of Villa Rosa for the book.
Well, you just mentioned him being that he painted. I was going to mention a few of the other things that are in the press release of accomplishments he had, and then maybe if you want to pick one of those out and just talk a little bit about it, that would be fine. He was the personal photographer to President Theodore Roosevelt. He witnessed the Wright brothers' first flight. He slept in the same room in a Tibetan monastery that Jesus did. He's indoctrined in Devoto. He met Rasputin and Mark Twain. He captured snakes and bank robbers. So, I mean, he had the gamut of adventure. So is there one of those particularly that when you discovered it was real, that just kind of popped out, like, I can't believe he did this?
Well, I tell you, it's kind of the combination. My thing is, Jason, I got to the point where I was saying, okay, I started thinking of the logistics. We're talking about 1906. How this young man from Virginia, with no money, with no real background, what have you, first of all, how he knew what was taking place and where the Wright brothers were going to try the flight, how he got there, how he managed, you know, and then from there to go from there to end up in Tibet, to end up in China, to end up in going from Alaska to Russia by dog sled and getting into Haiti and then spending 3 years in the Sahara. And I'm saying, my God, there's no way. I mean, it's not like today where we pick up a phone and say, would you book me a flight to Timbuktu or wherever you want to go and get me a hotel room and, by the way, get me a Hertz rental car at the same time. This guy was, how he did all of this, to me, just blew my mind. And it's I would say every one of them to me was a major undertaking. I'm gearing up to go to Los Angeles for 5 days, and I'm all stressed out. And this man just did, you know, he just did things that were just you can't fathom how he accomplished all of this. And then, of course, what he did, which was clever. When he was doing these things, he found out that he could make some money. This was before television, and a little bit of, you know, radio was kind of few and far between. He went on as an adventurer. He put on these lectures, and he'd get enough money to go to the next adventure from his lectures. And he did that for a while, and then he just went wherever he felt like he wanted to go, when he wanted to go, and there was no real discipline in or a clear objective in what he, in my mind, but to him, I'm sure his clear objective, it was very clear in his mind. He wanted to learn about people and people's religion, what makes people tick, and as many people of the world that he could get to, that was his objective, and I think he accomplished it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, this may be relevant, you know, the horrible incident at the Turkish airport, Atatürk airport. But and every time I hear about Turkey, I think of the time when Horace went over. First of all, he went over to do some promotional films to promote tourism in Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria. And then he went up to Turkey, and this was just after the Ottoman Empire ended, and there weren't places to stay. And he asked where he somehow met Pasha Kemal, who was Kemal Atatürk. And he spoke to him, and he and Atatürk had this conversation. And Kemal Atatürk, because Turkey wasn't developed, this was post-World War I, there was, you know, things weren't as they should be, invited him to stay in the palace. Can you imagine that happening today, where you just go over to a country you don't know, and you meet the future president of the country, for whom the country is named, and you wind up staying in his palace for 3 days?
It's amazing. And that's just one of many similar, you know, stories.
I think when you're a single traveler, I had a friend who was never married, and she was engaged to Joseph Kennedy Jr., who was killed in World War II, and she traveled extensively. She never married and went around the world on her own. And when you go around the world on your own and you're a single traveler and you're interested in other people, she found that she got invited to the palaces of princes and things like that. This was another era.
Right.
And era, I should say. And she, I don't know, people are more receptive to a single traveler, but especially someone like Horace, who showed a true interest in their culture and was willing to adapt easily to it. If it meant sleeping underground or in a hole, or, you know, out in the middle of the desert, he did it, which a lot of people...
Or in an igloo with an Eskimo.
Oh, my goodness.
It's just crazy.
Yeah. So those things stand out to me, that he was extremely adaptable and amenable, and he was obviously a people person.
Right.
This doesn't necessarily pertain to the book, but maybe does in a little bit. you still have strong ties to Haiti. Is, I mean, how's the country doing, you know, 6.5 years after the major earthquake? And
very sad, Jason. Very sad situation. Unfortunately, and I'm still very, as you say, very involved. I've gotten rid of all of my investments and properties and what have you. But I follow it very closely, and you can't have grown up and spent 60 years in the country and not just cut it right off. You know, there are ties that remain there, and family, indirect family, friends, close friends that I grew up with and what have you. And it's very sad. I don't see, and I am still quite involved. I'm consulted a few times, occasionally, by certain people that are more or less in the private sector that want to know what the situation is in Haiti, but also a little bit, not on this administration, but the previous administrations, U.S. government administrations, quite involved in giving my opinion for what it's worth and what have you. And I'm to say that it doesn't look, the future is not looking very bright in Haiti. Haiti, to me, is the closest thing you can find to a failed state. It's living what it's keeping its head afloat. I can compare it to somebody that's drowning, that much of the time their head is held underwater and they're pulled up as the last bubbles or just the last few breaths are left. They're pulled up just enough to get a few more breaths of air and start to shove back down again. The international community has gone about this very wrong, as far as I'm concerned. We have some major differences in, you know, we in America, we take so much for granted, first of all. Human rights to us is in Haiti, you got to think about, first of all, where is the next meal coming from, number one. Number two, if you fall ill, where is there going to be any health care? Number three, the generation that is upcoming, that is going to be the future of the country, needs to be educated so they know more or less how to deal with the day-to-day world or the day-to-day life and what have you. And there's a major failure on our, when I include the United States and the United Nations and all the countries that try to assist countries such as Haiti. And unfortunately, I'm not very optimistic about the future of the country. What's keeping it afloat now is so many Haitians, which are, I consider, like, I always say, if there's an Armageddon, the survivors are going to be the Haitians. They are real survivors. They're very hardworking people. They adapt to just about anything. They're all over the world. I'm sure you got some right there in Wisconsin, Jason, that they're doing some landscaping or doing something. But what I'm getting at is all these Haitians that are abroad are sending back, remitting dollars and currency to Haiti, to their families and to their relatives, and that's what's keeping the economy afloat. But socially, it is a mess. Insecurity is rampant. Now they're dealing with the Zika. The malaria, I almost died 3 times of malaria. There's 4 kinds of malaria. One is a falciparum malaria, which is the deadly one, and that's I got that one 3 times. But anyway, it's not a recurring one. You have to be reinfected every time. And the Zika thing now. Haiti is not. You know, they're doing a major effort now, trying to promote tourism and what have you. But the tourism that they're really promoting are really can count on to a certain degree are the Haitians that are living abroad, wherever they are, that are nostalgic to go back to their country and their culture and their food and what have you, and even to their voodoo. So that's what's keeping it afloat. But as far as the future of that country, it has a major management problem. It has for a long time. And unfortunately, the efforts that the developed countries have done for, basically, really, it's the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Taiwan to a certain degree of trying to help, but it's not much to show for it.
Danaea? Are you there, Danaea?
Hi, yes, sorry.
Yes, yes. Well, you've been in Haiti recently on Goodwill missions.
Yeah. I go down there to work with a school that is actually doing great things, and they have their first class, or graduating class of orphans that they took in when these kids were, you know, very young, when they were five, and they've actually raised them all the way up through, they've now graduated high school, and they're going on to, we're going on to college, and to try and become those new leaders that I think Mark is saying the country very desperately needs. I think there's some life for it, but it's a hard road.
Yes, it is.
For them, for sure.
And the other thing, Jason, that the works like this, I'm very involved also in indirectly helping a school that still exists in Haiti, has about 400 students, and I've actually donating some of our books, the proceeds, total proceeds from that book sales in a certain area, to that school to help it out. It's called the Bombergé School, but the one that I was getting at, what happens is once these students get educated, I would say every one of them, and I encountered this during my kidnapping. I never really kind of was brought front and center during the kidnapping, where what the head kidnapper told me, he says, Ashton, look around you. He says, everybody you see around you here has one point in mind, one goal, is to go to the United States of America. He didn't say the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but that's where our future is America. And he says, you're an American. If you're here in Haiti, where you can leave at any time, and all of us have one goal, is to go to the United States. And you're here, that means you're making an awful lot of money. Which, you know, that I never looked at it in that way up until that time. I kind of can understand to a certain degree, but that makes it even more difficult to help people a mentality like that. But a lot of that mentality was brought into the picture through the theology of liberation movement that was very strong in Haiti, and it's still pretty important. But so you're dealing with students. You educate them. You bring them to a certain point, and where they should be the future of your country. And 80% of them leave and go for a better life in Canada or in the United States or wherever, and you get maybe 10% that remain. But that's better than none. Of course.
Right.
So, but that makes it, my point I'm trying to make is that it's a very, very difficult long haul.
Okay, Lily.
I have never been to Haiti, but the one thing that struck me very hard in the book was that the people, the peasants, or the people who are so poor, have houses called TKs, which are so small that it doesn't allow the entire family to sleep at one time. So they have to sleep in shifts. And I was just astounded by that fact, Mark.
And they're the lucky ones. They're the ones that have a roof over their heads.
Yeah, they actually have a house.
Yeah, they actually have a house. You know, they're the lucky ones. But Didier knows it as well as I do. Having seen that down there, you know, you're talking about, like, when I was growing up in Haiti, there were a maximum of 2 million people in Haiti. There's over 10 million today, and that's one of the problems. This is the birth control. There should have been an effort to birth control, but you're dealing with the Catholic Church that was very, very predominant in Haiti. It's less now, but there's a lot of Protestant movements that are making inroads. But the Catholic Church, which preaches no birth control, bon Dieu bon, you know, they have the attitude of the Haitian people. Is God is good, and then he goes to his stepfather. Good, the good God is good, you know. Le bon Dieu est bon. So, and bottom line, they're saying, well, in their philosophy, have as many children as we can possibly have, because one of them will be a success and carry the rest of the load on his shoulders or her shoulders. So it's you know, you got a major overpopulation, a major erosion, deforestation problem. The land is, you know, there's just so much land to go around, and now you got so many more mouths to feed, and less potable, less producing land to feed these people. So it's a you know, a good friend of mine said years ago, you should be the president of ADS. I said, you know, all joking aside, I know what needs to be done. Could I do it? I don't think so, because it's more an educational process of the people like myself. When I was very involved in this whole economic scene and development scene in Haiti through the Haitian-American Chamber of Commerce and so on, I had as much education, much of a problem educating the people that are interested in investing in the country as I did as in educating the people that would benefit from that education. You got to, there's a bridge that has to be built there between so that the, for I had over 2,000 employees at one time. I was dealing with companies like Motorola and General Electric and TDR and DRW and what have you. And to get the people that are from these corporations, the foreign corporation, to come to Haiti, be a quality control manager, have them understand the culture of the workers, and then also have the workers understand what we're trying to accomplish here. And I one little example that comes to mind. I had one gal that was working for me. She was fantastic at winding coil, hand-winding electric coils. And she was so good, I said, okay, listen, I'm going to make you a supervisor. She said, Mr. Ashley, what did I do wrong? I said, you don't understand, sweetheart. You're doing so well that you need to show other people how to do it and to be above them. And so on. She said, please, Mr. Ashton, I can wind a coil with my eyes closed at night. I know I'm making $10 a day. I'm happy. Please don't put me in any... No, please don't take me away from... So and this is the kind of... This is just one small example of what the challenge that is at hand.
Libby, you won a Lifetime Achievement Award not all that long ago. The personal history field. Do you have any comments on that?
I was completely shocked that I won the award, and but I was very proud of it also. I love telling stories. I've always loved people and hearing their stories, and people seem to gravitate toward me. I've been in elevators where people just start talking to me and tell me their stories, much to my husband's chagrin, but I'll be in the vet's office with the dogs and someone will start telling me their stories, and I come home with amazing stories. I really enjoy helping people tell me or explain their lives, and I've worked with a woman who I remember she was nearly 100 when I worked with her. She was almost 107 when she passed, but she remembers the end. She remembered the end of World War One, and they lived in a small town up in Wyoming, and they were in a movie theater, and the Indians, this is politically incorrect, but the Native Americans came through on horses, riding through the movie theater because they were so excited the war ended. I worked with a lovely man who survived the Bataan Death March. And so I feel that I've gained so much from people's stories. I mean, yes, I was compensated for helping them tell their stories, but I learned so much from these people, and I've always felt that there's so much wisdom and untapped wisdom that is just not untapped wisdom because people aren't able to tell their stories. They don't have the ability. At one time I wanted to set up a program with schools where we trained either high school or junior college students to go in and interview people in senior centers to gather those stories, because I thought it would be a win for everyone involved. But I couldn't. I was working as a volunteer for the Museum of Ventura County. I was the chair of the oral history program, and I couldn't get enough adult volunteers to do it. And I thought, why don't we have students do it? Because they would, first of all, benefit from the stories. They'd learn an interviewing skill, and the seniors love to talk about their lives. But it never got off the ground. I don't know what to say about that award, except that it was completely unexpected, and it's very much appreciated. And I will always enjoy telling people's stories. Right now, I'm concentrating on telling some of my own. After we get this book out, I wrote a book prior to this called What Lies Within, and it's a story of my first 21 years, and I have another book that I've been working on called What Took You So Long, which is the story of finding my birth family at age 56. I was adopted. And so I have some stories that I'd share too, because I think they might help people. And that's really the reason I tell stories.
Well, I would like just to add, Jason deserves this award because she is a master at listening to people's stories, having the patience, and having the tact, the ability to lead a person to tell the story in the proper manner without taking the story away from the person, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Well,
thank you, Mark.
I think we'll look at winding this down here. Maybe if you want to each both maybe give your best sales pitch on the book.
Well, Libby, if you want to start.
The book is an amazing story of survival and resilience. And it's a father-son story. It's an adventure, and it will take you back in time, but it will also, it will take you back in time and lead you to the present. And it's just an amazing thrill ride. I would say that anyone who wants to learn a bit of history, learn about life in Haiti, and find out how a man can survive being taken at gunpoint by four thugs should read this book.
I would only add to that, Jason, and I'm not very good at selling whatever, myself especially, but I would add to that, both father and son, I were examples of never give up. Be confident in yourself and your inner strengths, and never, do not take no for an answer, do not accept failure, and never give up.
Well, it seems like I
covered all the other things.
I would only add that anything is possible if you want it.
Dania is probably the one that's best placed, because Dania came late into the game, so to speak, and Dania has been fantastic. She's been extreme. She when she read the story, she fell in love with the story, the whole thing. She's extremely devoted to the success of the book, and I can't thank her enough. She's a real sweetheart.
Well, Mark, it's been my pleasure. I mean, since the beginning, I've believed in just the universal appeal of this book. I think that it has, you know, everyone today is a bit of an adventure photographer because we have a camera in our pocket. But imagine when it was difficult to do that. And so for, you know, the younger generation, learn about where this came from. Learn about when the world was, it was tough to travel. Not simple when you got to kick back with the, you know, in-flight entertainment. But learn about where we came from and how some of the things that are so intrinsic to our lives today, how they evolve. And then for the older generation, it brings up so many, you know, things that maybe their parents talked about or some they maybe even experienced. So I truly think it has an incredible breadth of people that really, really can benefit from reading it.
I have to add, there have been so many incidents lately in the news that relate to this book, and one of them is the expansion of the Panama Canal recently, and the Chinese freighter going through on Sunday morning, where the Panama Canal, when your father went there with President Roosevelt, they were mired in mud and clay and rain for days, and Roosevelt recognized the man who was operating the steam shovel, and he said, "May I have a seat?" And that's where your father got that wonderful picture of President Theodore Roosevelt sitting on the steam shovel.
Right.
And so there's so much in the book that relates to life today and current news that I think it's really relevant and timely.
Well, I am certainly looking forward to getting deeper into the book myself, and I hope you both the best with this book. And who knows, as you said earlier, anything is possible. Maybe one day we'll be back talking about the movie adaptation of this book.
The movie, yeah, that would be lovely.